Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hello, Chris. Good to talk again. Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of The Other Hand. The Revenue Commissioners published their annual report this week, and a lot in there. And I think for anybody interested in what's happening in terms of the structural trends in Irish taxes, this annual report, and indeed the statistics that the Revenue Commissioners publish regularly on their website, there's invaluable stuff in there. I just wish I had enough time to delve into the sort of depth that it deserves. But the bit that struck me was the question of warehouse debt. As you know, Chris, I have been twittering on about the problems and the challenges facing the SME sector in this country for some time now. And I'm an unashamed supporter of SMEs in every sense. But one of the challenges that is now imminent is the question of warehouse revenue debt. During COVID, companies experiencing certain difficulties, as were many at the time, were given a holiday from paying various taxes. And this was called warehouse debt. And it was always the case that on the 1st of May, 2024, that warehouse debt would have to be paid back. Okay. And just to put some statistics on it, 53,172 customers of the Revenue Commissioners owe 1.58 billion in warehouse debt at the moment. Okay. And around 70% of those owe less than 5,000 euro. So not a significant problem for many companies. But, and this is where the big but is, 1.35 billion of that 1.58 billion in debt is owed by 9% of customers. That's 4,800 companies. So that's another significant challenge for many small businesses. But I guess the good news is that, number one, February this year, the interest rate that the revenue charges on that was reduced from a heavily discounted 3% to zero. So at least the debt isn't building up. And the second point is that companies can actually negotiate some sort of repayment schedule with the Revenue Commissioners. You know, you can pay it back over 2 or 3 years, depending on circumstances. And I think that's really important from a cash flow perspective. But I think I just put that out there because I think it is another interesting indicator of the sort of pressures.
Jim, that 4,000 odd companies that have a problem with these back, essentially this debt, the warehouse debt is a term for back taxes owed, isn't it? And this question is impossible to answer, I suspect, but I just wondered if you had a view. I don't have a view is a perfectly acceptable answer, because it's the answer I'd give, is do we expect from those 4,000 companies a sudden wave of bankruptcies, simply them putting their hands up and saying, we'll never be able to pay this debt, so therefore we're bust? Or would it be a trickle?
Well, the jury is out on that one, Chris. The insolvency and liquidation data published by PwC recently for the first quarter show a significant increase in insolvencies in the first quarter. But to put that in context, you know, during COVID, because of the various protections that were in place, there was a very low level of insolvencies. So, you know, we are now starting to normalize again. But certain sectors like retail and hospitality businesses, they are the ones that dominate this insolvency picture. So, and they, of course, are the ones, it's hospitality mainly and retail who are the ones that have allotted this debt warehouse. So I wouldn't be at all surprised. I would hope that the responsible managers of these businesses will negotiate a deal with the revenue commissioners that will actually align with their cash flow projections over the next 2 or 3 years. So I hope you would avoid just a sudden surge in insolvencies. I suspect it will be more of a trickle. But, you know, within the restaurant sector, I've spoken about it before, but there's a particular problem there given the business pressures, and we're seeing a lot of restaurants closing down at the moment. I haven't answered your question because I don't know, but
No, that is the answer I expected, actually, because I'm not sure how anybody could know, but I just wondered if you had any particular views. I think the answer, a trickle of insolvencies, is probably in the right ballpark. But as you also say, we just don't know. There is a risk that a lot of your local businesses may be in some trouble.
Indeed. So it'll be one to watch. And that's why I highlight those figures this morning. Chris, moving further afield, looking at what's happening in the United States, and this brings us back to the debate we've been having. And can I be very clear on this?
I doubt it.
That at the beginning... At the beginning of the year, I said that the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates in 2024. You said it wouldn't. Okay, that was the bet. You've been meandering around that and fudging it in all sorts of ways subsequently.
I think there's a Stalinist rewriting of history going on here, Jim, but carry on.
Yesterday, we got the first quarter GDP data for the United States, annualized growth of 1.6%. That's the lowest level since the first half of 22. Consumer spending expanding, but the growth rate has weakened to 2.5%, down from 3.3%. Non-residential investment expenditure has also weakened, and the government expenditure has also weakened significantly to 1.2% from 4.6%. So clear signs of some slowdown in the economy. I suspect, though, based on my analysis of US data, that this initial estimate will be revised up over the next month or so. But it certainly feeds into something you were alluding to in our last podcast, which made me think that actually there might be a future for you in economic forecasting after all, because you were saying and predicting some slowdown in global activity now, or particularly in the United States. But, and you can explain that in a second. But the other, so that those GDP data by themselves would suggest that the argument is now on my side that the Federal Reserve will cut rates. But then there's always a sting in the tail. The inflation measure contained within that, which is the PCE, which is the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation, it came in at a high 3.7%. The market had been expecting 3.4%. So that in turn has dampened interest rate cut expectations. US bond yields, we spoke about them the other day and spoke about how 5% was a possible target for the 10-year. It's up at 4.69% at the close of business last night. So it's a little bit of a mixed picture.
I think I'll be more nuanced than even you try to be there, Jim, which is that my story, my narrative, if you like, was less about interest rate cuts, the number, the quantum, whatever, but just the tone of the story, which was that there were markets were pricing in 6 or 7 rate cuts at the beginning of the year. And I've always thought that was for the birds. And I never put a number on how many that I thought. I figured that we're both going to claim victory if the Fed just cuts once, to be honest. But let's move on from the actual Chris Johns, Jim Power argument about US interest rates. The second part of my narrative was that really since the end of last year, we've been talking about how global growth led by the United States is much stronger than consensus economic forecasters seem to think. And the numbers came in to suggest that we were right. And so the second part of my nuanced story was that I felt that we were reaching peak optimism on growth, in particular as the IMF, who reflect, if you like, the consensus amongst all the good economic forecasters out there, suggested that the short-term growth prospects were very, very good. And that was how it was written up. So I took that as a bit of a contrary indicator. I took that as a sign that our story had become mainstream, that where we were out of consensus, that we had become consensus. So it was time to move the story on. And I felt that over the next while, we're not likely to get quite as good a run of economic news as we've had over the really since the beginning of the year, four months now. And so it has proved with that one data release. So I'm not going to do a victory lap on the back of one data release, which, as you rightly say, will probably be revised. But it was a bit of a shocker in the sense that it was the first really big, weak economic number that we've had out of the States for some time. It was GDP. And when you delved into the components, the headline number probably told too pessimistic a story.
Yeah.
And the various moving parts of GDP suggested it wasn't quite as bad as it first appeared. But the stock market initially took fright and then decided that probably it wasn't that bad. But the stock market as a whole has stopped going up. And indeed, over the last few weeks, it has gone down, as I think the economic picture has become much more mixed. And that adding to that mixture is, as you say, the inflation story. And there is a building inflation story that price rises in the United States are stuck. And they're stuck at around the 3-point-something level. And the Fed really shouldn't be cutting if it's serious about getting inflation down to 2%. Or maybe that, like Roadrunner, the US economy is finally going to fall off a cliff. Because I think one of the important things to remember is talking about economic forecasts is if you go back 18 months or so, if you'd said back then that US interest rates were going to go from 0 to over 5%, most economists would have said that there would have been a hard landing for the US economy, a big growth slowdown, if not an actual recession. And everybody's been surprised. Everybody who made that forecast has been surprised by it not happening. The caveat to the big interest rate cut story, or at least the caveat to the expectation that I have now that we're not going to get the big interest rate cuts, is that the US economy finally does, like Roadrunner, fall off the cliff all of a sudden. I don't think that's happening. I don't think it will happen, but it's always a risk when you have these big interest rate moves. So the problem that the Fed has now is that inflation is clearly stuck at the 3-point-something level. And I think that means that the market is saying that there's a 33% chance of 2 rate cuts this year. That's now the consensus expectation. So that, I think, I would say this, wouldn't I, vindicates the stance that I've taken. So if that economic weakness that started yesterday with the release of those GDP figures, if there's a run of weak economic data, then I think that the interest rate markets will then reprice interest rate cuts. So it does all depend, as always. So I think we're both claiming a victory, aren't we, Jim?
Yeah, I think we are, Chris. Overnight, we had results from Alphabet and Microsoft, which clearly feed into the US equity market narrative. Alphabet's revenue up 15% to $80.5 billion. It's announced it's paying its first ever dividend, and the share price increased 18% after trading. Microsoft announced a 17% growth in revenues to $61.9 billion. And the interpretation that's put on both of those results is that their AI bets are actually paying off, you know, the investment and the resources they are devoting in that direction. Is working. So, you know, this we've spoken many times about the sort of concentration risk in the US equity market and how the big tech companies were driving it. But, you know, the reality is that the earnings of the big tech companies in general seem pretty healthy at the moment. And that brings me to something else, Chris.
Can I just stop you there, James, because you missed out one company that was results earlier in the week, which was Meta or Facebook.
Yes, indeed.
And the moment its results came out, the shares dropped nearly 20%
in
what's called after market trading. Trading after the official close of the New York Stock Exchange is always thin, and not too much attention should be paid to it. On the day after the results went in official trading, the shares were actually off just about 10%, so not as bad as the aftermarket trading. And the reason for that big slide in Meta is that they announced a big, big spending increase in investment in AI.
Yeah.
And it's a bet that could take years to pay off. Now, I think this is the stock market at its absolute worst. I think it confirms all of the doubts that many people who know a lot about stocks have, and quite a few of the doubts that people who don't know a lot have. And the latter are the people who just think that it's all a blooming casino. And I think that they would be forgiven for thinking that was the case. The slide in the shares because of the rise in capital investment speaks to the short-termism of the stock market, both in the US and in a lot of other countries, particularly the UK. And in a different world, we would reward companies that say we're investing for the long term. We would say, yeah, investing is always a risky bet. Sometimes investments pay off, sometimes that they don't. But give companies the benefit of the doubt that try to reinvest their cash. The market doesn't do that anymore, hardly at all, and really only rewards instant gratification, which is that when companies announce dividends, when they announce share buybacks, when they announce big increases in revenues that they're not going to spend, the share price goes up in the short term. But of course, that sows the seeds of the destruction of the share price in the long term. If a company doesn't invest, it's the same thing as a country not investing. After all, a country investing is just the sum of all the investments that companies, individuals, and governments do. If companies don't invest, then they won't grow. And if countries don't invest, they don't grow. So the idea that you would punish a company for increasing its capital investment, to me, is just the short-termism of the market on steroids and justifies an awful lot of the critiques that are made about stock market casino-like behavior. And it's not just Meta, it's everywhere. And it's been for years that the market rewards cash generation and short-termism. CEOs know this. They know that their tenure is short and that their remuneration depends on share prices because they have so many options and other ways of being linked to the share price of the company that they're trying to manage. So in trying to boost the share price of any company, what a CEO does is the first thing he thinks about every single morning, he or she, when they wake up, is how do I cut costs and how do I not spend? It's nuts. If you want to think about one of the many reasons why some countries have economic problems, it's that kind of corporate behavior. It doesn't get a lot of publicity, but it's real, it's massive, and it really speaks to the short-termism of our age. Rant over, Jim.
Yeah, Chris, you have been a constant critic of the UK economy. You've buried it over the last couple of years, never to be resurrected, etc.
I think it's buried itself, Jim. Nothing to do with me.
Hold on a sec now, Chris. What about the FTSE?
What about it?
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The FTSE 100, as we speak, Jim, is at another all-time high. I imagine that's what you're alluding to. That it's gone nowhere now. It's gone up a little bit this century. But if you compare it to any other major stock market, particularly the US, it's an also-ran. You just you'd see two lines, one going up a lot and one going up hardly at all. The one goes up a lot is the US. The one that goes up hardly at all is the UK for decades. So that's the first thing to say, is that the latest rise, welcome though it is not a hill of beans if you put it in proper historic context. The second thing is that the FTSE 100 is not representative of the UK economy. It's full of international companies, some more dodgy than others, that choose to have their listing in the UK and make their money elsewhere. I'm talking about things like big oil companies, things like that. It doesn't. There is a bit of the UK economy in the FTSE, absolutely, but it's more in some other indices rather than the FTSE 100. The latest rise in the FTSE 100 is a function of the fact that the pessimism over the UK and the extent to which the FTSE does represent the UK has been overdone, and I've acknowledged that. And that what we call the valuation of these shares just reached ridiculously low levels, which in part at least is justified because you're valuing the UK in a way and you're saying it's not worth very much, which is fine. But I think that process has gone too far. That's one reason why the market's gone up. Another is that one big mining company tried to buy another yesterday, and merger and acquisition activity is something that gets the market excited much, much more than a company spending money on itself, because that's, again, merger and acquisition activity. When one company buys another, is instant gratification for the shareholders of the company that's being bought, because inevitably they always end up paying a premium relative to the last share price. So it's markets always get excited when there's M&A activity, and so it has proved with the FTSE over the last few days. And I still stand on my assessment that the UK economy, it's not in recession, but neither is it going anywhere in a hurry.
Thank you, Chris. I was actually playing devil's advocate there, because I would 100% agree with what you're saying about the FTSE. I mean, if you look at its performance last year, for example, in a pretty stellar year for global equity markets, the FTSE was one of the poorest performers. So, yeah, I thought it was important to sort of elicit that from you to explain to our listeners what's going on in that equity market. There's a few stories I want to just allude to very, very quickly before I want to get on to something more substantive. The Bank of Japan has left interest rates unchanged. The yen has gone to 156 against the dollar, which is a 34-year low. You know, it's literally falling out of bed as we speak. So that's
time to visit Japan.
Indeed. That's what I was just going to say. That is really good news for the Japanese export performance, and exports are still an incredibly important part of that economy. Moving to India, and believe it or not, Chris, we actually do have quite a few Indian listeners to this podcast.
We do.
The Italian electorate is going to the polls this weekend. Prime Minister Modi is...
You said Italian there, Jim, rather than...
Did I say Italian? Sorry, I beg your pardon. Indian.
You're getting me even more confused than I normally am.
Okay, I'll start again. The Italian...
You said it again.
There I go. Yeah. The Indian electorate is going to the polls this weekend. The expectation is that Prime Minister Modi will win this election quite easily, which would give him a historic third term in office. And we won't know the results because the votes aren't counted actually until the 4th of June. But India fascinates me in many ways. I came across a statistic recently showing that 5% of the Indian population is deemed to be in poverty at the moment. That's down from 12% in 2011. So for the most populated country in the world, there is remarkable economic and social progress being made in that country. It is coming from a low base, but you know, it's a fascinating country because it is a massive democracy, and I think increasingly will become more and more influential in global economic affairs.
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be led by somebody that is friendly towards Russia. has certain beliefs and characteristics consistent with strongman leaders. I was starting to think of the right description for Modi, because you can't call him a totalitarian or a demagogue, or can you? Maybe you can.
I don't think so.
He's democratically elected. I mean, that's the most important thing to say. But there are doubts about his aggressively nationalistic approach that he takes and the way it excludes certain sections of society.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that the Indian economy is on a tear, as you say. Mm. And from a human perspective, at least, that can only be welcomed.
We have spoken in the past about the politics of climate change and the difficulties it's creating, and we're going to see that reflected in the local and European elections here, I think, in June, where there is a little bit of a backlash against the sort of green agenda. I notice Humza Yousaf, the First Minister of Scotland, is facing a vote of no confidence because the power-sharing deal he had with the Greens in Scotland has collapsed, and that's because the SNP has moved away from its most ambitious climate targets. So here again, we have a First Minister responding to sort of populist pressures, and is causing serious political difficulties within the country.
Maybe that short-termism that I spoke about at the corporate level with respect to Facebook, Meta, as an example, at one of thousands that I could cite about the stock market punishing companies that spend money in the form of capital investment, spend money really in creating the future for the company and therefore for all of us, is that the whole climate change debate is swinging in that way as well, in that the electorate is punishing people that want to spend money on sorting out the climate. And we just simply punish politicians who want to spend that money. So there's a read across there. Jim, I got a point of principle to ask you. And yeah, again, you may kick for touch on this one because it's very controversial. When it comes to spending on climate, Ireland is continuously urged to do more, as are all countries. And indeed, Ireland is doing something. And all of the requests for doing more really, I think, are well-intentioned and well-meant. And people are very sincere about the fact that Ireland should become the Saudi Arabia of wind and do more for alternatives generally and have carbon taxes, all those good things that we know about environmental policies. But what we also know, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, is that Ireland, for all of its good efforts, if it doubled, trebled, went up by a factor of 10. If it eliminated all its carbon emissions to zero, let's just imagine that thought experiment, wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to global warming, would it? Because it's simply too small. And it's China and the United States that are the ones that are ultimately going to have to solve this problem. Would you agree with that?
I would 100% agree with you, yeah.
But would you also agree that nevertheless, morally, ethically, philosophically, it's still right for Ireland to try?
Of course it is. And I actually think that in this whole global debate, that small countries, if they do amazing things, can actually have a significant global impact.
Yeah, leading by example. Just being ethical about it, doing the right thing, being seen to do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though the consequences, the direct consequences of what you're doing are pretty nil, you hope that there are lots of indirect consequences. Okay, that's the principle of spending money on averting climate change. In the UK and elsewhere, well, throughout NATO, there's been a big debate for years now, going all the way back to John F. Kennedy, actually, about NATO members doing more. With the exception of the United States, that very few of them until recently reached the objective of 2% of GDP spending on defence. And the UK has just announced it's going to 2.5%. There's loads of smoke and mirrors around that. Won't go into that now. And it wants all NATO members to now regard the new floor for defence spending to be 2.5% of GDP. It's a big deal. Do you know how much Ireland spends on defence as a proportion of GDP? Now, in case you don't, I'll tell you. It's about 0.3. Now, that's because Ireland is a neutral country. 0.3% GDP is a legitimate political choice for Ireland to make as a neutral country. And you could rightly say, a bit like climate change, If Ireland adopted a 2.5% of GDP target to show solidarity with NATO, not joining it, I'm not suggesting that for a second, that would be another, let me just, well, I'll come back to that in a second, but that would be another way in which it would make no difference whatsoever to total military spending in the world if Ireland went to 2.5% of GDP, because it's just, GDP is just too small in a global context. It wouldn't deter Russia from starting the next phase of the next European war. Some of us think that's already started. But nevertheless, as a member of the EU now, I know you're not a member of NATO, do you think that it's a bit like climate change? The time has come to have that debate about Irish neutrality, maybe even joining NATO and joining in with the rest of Europe in European defence, because there are many people, and I'm beginning to think I'm one of them, that the next European war has started and it's going to get an awful lot worse before it gets better. And simply sheltering under the NATO umbrella, simply being neutral, a la Switzerland, morally, ethically, philosophically, just doesn't cut it going forward.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the the global geopolitical environment in the last 5 years particularly, I mean, it's becoming more and more dangerous, more and more difficult, more and more threatening. And for a country like Ireland, you know, I think there is now a massive vulnerability. And I would say we do need to up our defence spending to 2.5% of GDP.
Well, that's not going to happen, is it, Jim?
It's not going to happen, but it should, okay? The second thing is that I don't think we can stand idly by at this stage and not stand up to our sort of global obligations in terms of defence as such.
I wonder if the question that I'm asking, Jim, is if that geopolitical situation is as bad as we seem to think it is, and if Putin is determined to get the old Soviet Union back, which means attacking NATO countries like Poland, is being neutral and a member of the EU going to be compatible in that world?
I don't think so, but I've believed that for quite some time, you know, full stop.
I think neutrality is a legitimate political choice for any country to make, absolutely.
But is it the right one?
That's a different question. But yeah. I just think it's in the world that we think we might be moving into, it might be incompatible with being a member of the EU, which is a big, big deal for Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed, absolutely, given that everything we've done since 1973 has been driven very strongly by becoming more and more integrated into the European Union. And you'd have to think that some of our European partners will start to get very pissed off about this at some stage if the more apocalyptic views on European war and so on actually, you know, materialize in a more concrete way.
Yeah, well, that's a controversial one, Jim, and I know how emotive and strong feelings there are in Ireland about neutrality, and I think the majority of Irish people, my sense is that they still cling to neutrality as something that they still want. And I think that we've just expressed some deeply unpopular views. Would that be right? Or do you think sentiment has shifted?
Oh, it's deeply unpopular. There's no doubt about it. But I could actually write a profile for you of the people who actually are in favour of our neutrality at this stage. Okay, I generalise a little bit. But there are a lot of common characteristics here. I think we've got to recognize the reality of the very vulnerable position we're in at the moment. And, you know, I've heard Dan O'Brien, an economist and commentator I respect an awful lot. I've heard him say a lot about this in recent times. And I have to say, I 100% agree with him.
But it is profoundly depressing, taking perhaps the other side of the argument.
Of course it is.
The Stockholm International Institute for Peace Studies or something like that added up the amount of military spending that there was in the world in 2023, and it was $2.5 trillion, Jim.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Can you imagine the good that could do?
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, there's no doubt about it.
We need to acknowledge just how awful this vista is that we're talking about, and how much better the money could be, the uses the money could be put to for our health, education, welfare, infrastructure, all those other better ways of spending public sector money. I think we need to acknowledge that. But the world is moving in one direction, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Chris, somebody said to me last night, I was at an event and I shared the video with you. I was engaged in a fundraiser in UCD that my MBA class organized for the Irish Hospice Movement, and you saw my athletic prowess on a bike. But somebody came up to me and said, could you not be more cheerful on the podcast?
All right. And on that note, I think we should probably end today's, which is that I think everybody should be smiling. If only I could show you now. We should have a YouTube channel, Jim. The sight of you, how do I describe this stationary bike that you were? It looked like you were attacking it, Jim. It looked like you were having a fight with it.
I have a very competitive nature, Chris.
Jim, it's been great to talk. Yeah, have a fabulous weekend.
Likewise, can I just say one other thing, an interesting statistic I want to throw out just to really finish this on a low note. I have a nephew, Thomas, who works in the wine industry in Sonoma in California. The winery is called Sebastiani, a beautiful place next to the Algarve and Dungarvan. You know, this is probably my third favorite place on earth. It's heaven. But anyway, global wine production last year fell by 10%, largely due to climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real
shock. Stock up.
Absolutely. I am. Cheers, Jim.
Good luck.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.